81. The current numbers, humidity a tad high at 80%. Wind is calm. Sunshine with 64 degrees, Racine 63 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is up next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm always happy when I can welcome into our studios Dr. Art Sear. He's been a mainstay of the morning show for decades now, a monthly visitor to the program, offering his thoughtful reflection on a wide array of issues and concerns, both here and abroad. I know that many of you read his column, which appears in newspapers all across the country, author of the book After the Cold War, and again, someone whose presence on the morning show I very much value. And we have some really interesting things to explore over the next few minutes. And Professor Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much. We were discussing loyalty off the air a couple minutes ago, and your loyalty to me is greatly appreciated.
Well, and your loyalty to WGTD is appreciated as well.
Well, thank you. Let's try to keep that up.
So let's talk, first of all, although I don't believe you have devoted any of your recent columns to it, but of course, since your last time on the morning show, the already tumultuous presidential race became still more tumultuous with President Biden's decision to withdraw from the race, to not yes. seek a second term, and for Kamala Harris to very quickly assert herself as the presumptive nominee of the
yes,
Democratic
indeed.
Party. So first of all, I'm curious if anything about the way all of this has unfolded has surprised you, including President Biden's decision to step down from his reelection bid. Did that surprise you? And otherwise, what ensued in the wake of his decision, if any of that, has also unfolded in any way that surprised you?
Yes, I was surprised, but that's kind of the story of my life. I'm very, very good at discussing the past and sometimes good at discussing the present, but I've been around long enough to know that invest for the future, dollar cost averaging, don't take big gambles financially or otherwise, because I'm not very good at predicting future events. I'm really not, personally or professionally.
Hmm. So you were, first of all, were you surprised that President Biden made the decision that he ultimately did? Did that surprise you?
Yeah, I thought he would keep running, actually. So I hope all our listeners don't immediately turn off their radios or their computers or switch. But it was surprising, but it wasn't. I mean, there has been pressure building for him within his own party, among the leaders, and it was clear that that was growing. I admire him for stepping down. I thought he might really just stick it out. When you're the president of the United States, it's you got an awful lot of power, even if you're beleaguered and in trouble politically. So I admire him for stepping down. He's had a very long career, very distinguished career. I think history is going to remember him pretty well. He's had some major failures in the White House, including the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. But he shows what you can do with ability and determination, a very long career, and he did not start out with any particular family connections. Unlike many in Congress today, the Senate especially has become a millionaire's club. That was not the case through almost all of the 20th century.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, in the wake of that decision then, the Democratic Party had to figure out who to present to the country as their new presidential candidate. And, of course, there's nothing set in stone that said that that had to be Kamala Harris or would be Kamala Harris. And there was the very real possibility that there might be actually a contest,
I mean,
a competition between various contenders. And may the best man or woman win. And nothing like that really ensued. Did that surprise you, or did this unfold kind of the way you thought it most likely would?
Well, as his final decision to withdraw implies, there was a lot of organized pressure at the top. That's a reasonable inference. And the same people who are quite powerful within the Democratic Party, including especially former Speaker Pelosi, because of her outstanding track record of getting things done as Speaker, in contrast to Republican speakers before and since, she and others, I believe, carefully organized the next steps. But it shows also there's no really popular insurgent. Party insurgencies happen, especially in the Democratic Party in the past. And not the only example, but probably the most germane example, is when President Lyndon Johnson stepped down from the presidency. Again, he served out his term, but he announced on March 31st, 1968, that he would not be pursuing renomination. And what ensued was chaos.
It sure was.
In a very chaotic, very violent year, which included the assassination of his most feared opponent, but not most likely opponent, Senator Robert Kennedy, and, of course, the tragic killing of Dr. King. I was old enough. I was in grad school at the time, and I was quite young, and it's tough to be young, but it's the one time in my life when I think the country really did seem to be coming apart.
Right. And, of course, that Democratic convention, which also was in Chicago, was a very rocky, tumultuous, disconcerting spectacle in and of itself. So
A riot outside in Chicago, a police riot as well as a public riot of enormous numbers of very well-organized demonstrators, anti-war demonstrators, but also there was a kind of anarchy in the land. And there was also rioting within the Democratic Convention Hall itself, and poor Dan Rather of CBS got beaten up by apparently security guards, but that's unclear. There were a lot of rough guys from the Democratic Party organization who kind of got out of control way back then. By contrast, I had the privilege of attending the 1996 Democratic Convention in Chicago. I had a challenging two-year successful job. I'm very proud, but a challenging 2 years running the World Trade Center in Chicago. I'm very proud of what we accomplished working together. Neil Hardigan, a longtime Illinois-Chicago politician who almost became governor in 1990, it was his show. He was the chairman, and he recruited me. and was very well connected. He had a good personal relationship with President Clinton. So thanks to Mr. Hartigan, I attended the convention. I did not realize previously there were so many female Chicago police officers in Chicago. And everyone seemed to have been to sensitivity training. I kept expecting to be handed a bouquet of flowers, but I was I was just there, but I was constantly asked if I was okay. And I was very politely welcomed and checked in when I got to, I guess, the United Center. Anyway, different from 68.
Yes, for sure, for sure, absolutely. And, of course, one of the most important decisions once it became clear that Kamala Harris was the presumptive nominee is who her vice presidential running mate should be. And, of course, a lot of people were actually surprised by her ultimate choice, Governor Waltz from Minnesota, who was not on very many short lists of likely choices. He has proven to be a very energetic addition to the mix.
Yeah.
Do you have any impressions of him you want to share, anything that intrigues you about him?
Well, as an old white guy, I really like older white guys being prominent and powerful, but efforts to be humorous aside, I admire his and J.D. Vance's personal stories, especially Vance, who came up from abject poverty and a really difficult early life. They both served in the military quite honorably. I think, as an armchair strategist on the sidelines, it would have been better for the candidates in the country if they had gone more toward the middle or someone else, not picked someone who in policy terms is also clearly on the left or the right. I have a great personal respect and professional respect for Tim Scott, speaking of the black senator, Republican senator from South Carolina, which used to be called the cradle of the Confederacy for very good reasons. Just tactically, I think it would be better if the candidates had reached out. Apparently, Silicon Valley billionaires, the uber-powerful overlords of high tech, have been moving more and more toward the Republican Party, at least a lot of the most visible ones, compared to the 90s when President Clinton and Vice President Gore did a very good job of cultivating Silicon Valley at that time. And there was an awful lot of financial and political pressure, I gather, for Trump to pick J.D. Vance, who hasn't been around very long, but he's moved very fast to cultivate that very, very powerful, increasingly powerful population.
I'm struck by the fact that Governor Waltz has a background as a public school teacher and a football coach.
Yes.
And I mean,
to
me, that's an interesting injection of something refreshing. I mean, whatever you might think about his stance on various issues and so on, just the fact that we're talking about somebody who, although certainly has some political experience, his roots are in something very different. And this is somebody of modest means, doesn't own any stocks, no bonds. He is not a wealthy man, and he has not moved in wealthy circles. I'm just intrigued by that. That's all I want to say about that.
That's a really important point. I wish I'd said that. Yeah, he's a policy aside, he's a regular guy and a regular American.
And we don't often see family. And we don't often see regular people in these particular arenas in those kind of prominent positions. So.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever happened to them? Well, we'll find out maybe.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Psychologically. Yeah, you're absolutely. That's a very important point. Thank you very much for making that point.
Well, let's get on to other matters. And for those of you just joining us, we have with us Dr. Art Sear for his monthly visit to the program. In stark contrast to what's going on at the moment, one of your recent columns looks back 50 years to an anniversary, actually as of this month, in fact, pretty close to this exact date, I think.
That's why I wrote it.
And that is the resignation of Richard Nixon. Do I remember he was our 37th president, I think, something like that?
That sounds right. I don't know.
But back in 1974, and of course, I would I would suspect that a lot of our listeners remember that very, very vividly. One of the points, interestingly, in your column about Mr. Nixon and his resignation was, I mean, you really take kind of a holistic or comprehensive approach to him, including some of his largely forgotten, I mean, some of them are very much forgotten, accomplishments and successes, including one that I think, I'm not sure I had any awareness of whatsoever, involving civil rights. And this was back when he was President Eisenhower's vice president. Tell our listeners about this important moment in Mr. Nixon's career that a lot of us either never knew about or have forgotten.
Well, the Republicans, pushed civil rights legislation more effectively than the Democrats until the 1960s, when things changed dramatically, thanks significantly to Lyndon Johnson, but also dramatic public changes, popular opinion changes that we've alluded to already. In 1957, the Republicans, Southern Democrats, were very powerful, crucial to getting elected. Big reason why Kennedy picked Johnson in 1960 as his running mate, John Kennedy. The Republicans got through major civil rights legislation related to very practical, very unemotional, not hot-button issues, but basic bread-and-butter issues, earning a living. The 1957 Civil Rights Act especially stands out, which was a priority for President Eisenhower. Nixon, from the beginning, was a very staunch advocate of civil rights, in contrast to Jack Kennedy, for instance, and of necessity Lyndon Johnson, until he became a great civil rights leader when he became president. The Republicans spent entirely too much time sitting around the Oval Office complaining about the fact we don't get any credit for this, including the president and vice president. But in terms of employment guarantees, giving the Justice Department very, very powerful tools to enforce voting rights and enforce employment rights and enforce civil rights, the 57 law was very, very important. And the media tends today, in terms of dominant media, have bias. And I think the Democrats have done a much better job of wooing not just African Americans, but other minority voters. That's changing in interesting ways. But through the 50s, African Americans tended to vote very heavily. Those who could vote in the North, heavily Republican. Richard Nixon had a good personal relationship with Dr. Martin Luther King, and you'd find Republicans dealing with civil rights leaders more than a big section of the Democratic Party.
That's fascinating. In other words, like, for instance, you mentioned JFK and LBJ specifically. What you're suggesting is Richard Nixon was working on civil rights earlier than either of them were.
That's right.
Yeah.
But again, it changed in the 60s.
Right.
Nixon was an instrumental catalyst in the so-called Southern strategy to bring the Republican Party to unprecedented power in the South. And that has worked extraordinarily well over the long term. That very much overshadows their earlier civil rights commitment.
Right. You mentioned also some of Mr. Nixon's accomplishments as president.
Yes, indeed.
And I think most of us retain a pretty vivid awareness of what he accomplished in terms of foreign policy, particularly in terms of his outreach to China in, of course, really dramatic fashion.
Yeah.
I think much less remembered is the hand he had in creating the Environmental Protection Agency during his presidency.
Early in 1969, dramatic backdrop to Nixon's inauguration, finally, as president, the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, Ohio, caught fire. Pollution, petroleum, all kinds of garbage, flammable junk in the river caught fire. No one was injured or killed, no people. A railroad bridge was seriously damaged. It made huge media across the country. I mean, it's a river in a big city. Suddenly, igniting. And Nixon took good advantage of that to get through the EPA. And he was not a particularly conservative Republican. He was a strain that's faded from the party, but he was actually quite liberal in many ways, more liberal, again, than Kennedy in important respects. And he was able to force his way onto the ticket with Ike in 1952 for a couple of good practical reasons, one of which was he was a bridge between the anti-communist Joe McCarthy wing, which had become quite dominant in the media and public attention. They were basically old-time isolationist, often know-nothing Republicans, and the internationalist wing of the party, which was not dominant, but was, except in presidential elections, and was crucial to Eisenhower getting the nomination in 52. Good old Ike, the great magician, was very good at seeming inevitable after he had overcome monumental barriers. He was not the front runner in 52. And Nixon was able to position himself so that Eisenhower wanted him, contrary to what Ike implied later. Ike wanted him as his running mate. Can become kind of endlessly Byzantine, which is facilitates me talking too long on the radio. But no, Nixon's career is quite talented. I'm convinced that history is going to treat Nixon quite well.
Right. Well, and it seems to me that history already treats him better now than, for instance,
yes.
20 or 30 years ago.
Well put, thank
you. You said at one point in this column, Nixon's road was never easy.
No.
And you go on to say, sometimes self-defeating ways were combined with remarkable effectiveness. I think that's, I appreciate you highlighting that aspect of Mr. Nixon's political career, the fact that it's maybe a really good word for it is checkered, and I'm not alluding to the checker speech.
The famous dog, the Cocker Spaniel.
But just the fact that he had really impressive skills, but also certain demons that really undermined his success, or maybe limited his success. It's fascinating to think about that.
It is, yeah. I had the privilege of being around him twice. He ran for governor of California in 1962, which tends to be forgotten, after the very narrow loss to Kennedy in the popular vote, not the Electoral College. He ran for governor of California. Eisenhower implored him not to do it. Dick, it's going to be a big mistake for you. But he did, and was defeated very decisively by Pat Brown. I worked at Alexander's Supermarket in Hollywood, California, after school and on weekends, and I have a clear memory of showing up for work on a Saturday. I was quite young, but I noticed all these young ladies wearing white cheerleader outfits, more and more of them all the time. I was sitting in my car because I used to get to work early so I wouldn't be late. And they had, as I mentioned once before in your program, boaters with big blue N's on the top. And big blue N's. So I knew something was up. So anyway, I was interested, and I asked, and Vice President Nixon's coming. And he did show up and make a speech, very small crowd. And I had a chance to introduce myself and say hello. I've been around very few men who looked as exhausted and defeated as Nixon did toward the end of his disastrous campaign, and that's when he gave his famous last press conference, which people thought had finished him off for good.
That's right. You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. He said this to the media.
Pat Nixon apparently tried to hold on to him and keep him from going downstairs along with AIDS, but self-destructive. In 88 or 89, the former president spoke to the Economic Club of Chicago, a prestigious business-related group. I am a member of that organization. 3,000 people were there, the biggest attendance they'd had. There was a separate auditorium with a video feed for the first time because it was so huge. Zha Zhao, now retired, was a very successful lawyer in Chicago with Baker and McKenzie, which early on, back in the 50s and 60s, was operating in Europe, Britain, China, Japan, initially Japan at least. She had been Nixon's interpreter when he went to China on the historic path-breaking 1972 trip.
Wow.
And because she became quite active in the council when she moved here from China, and so I was acquainted with her, and I was invited to the private reception, I think because I let them know that I would be bringing her, and she was, in effect, a VIP. And I, of course, invited Mrs. Sear. And the private reception was rather sizable. Nonetheless, it was a chance to really get close and talk briefly to the former president. He, Zha Zhao, and he shook hands, but then he embraced her. He grabbed her, and it was really an affectionate hug by both of them. And Nixon was not a big hugger.
Right.
And then he had a few kind words from Mrs. Sear. And then I shook hands with him, and I was really naughty. I said, "Nice to see you again, Mr. President." And suddenly Nixon froze. Who is this guy?
Yeah. You know,
think of being a politician, Greg, meeting thousands of people.
Of course.
And he said, "You look," and then he recovered, "You look great, really terrific. How's the family doing?"
Wow.
He gave a phenomenal speech. He didn't have a podium, didn't have notes. He stood with a floor mic, and that was it. And he talked for about an hour, just a tour de force of the world, one of the most thorough and detailed, knowledgeable speeches I've ever heard. Grace Berry, who was a friend of Mrs. Daley, Richard M., and very well connected. She was the president of the club. And that's another reason I got into the private reception, not the main one. She and I talked afterwards, and she said Nixon got to town 3 days early and did nothing but hibernate in his hotel room. It's not your typical politician. And lived on room service, but all he did was focus obsessively on this speech.
Wow.
And did a phenomenal job. So I talked too long, but this is important, you know. Nixon is a lot more interesting than he got credit for from the media and others, including a lot of Republicans who didn't like him.
Yeah. And of course the gigantic headline is his resignation from office. And what you're suggesting is, although there's no denying how important that was and unprecedented in American history, that there is more to Nixon than his resignation, and that's what your column calls our attention to.
Yeah, and that resignation, with 2020 hindsight, opened the door. You know, impeaching a president was considered, well, that's just beyond the pale. That happened to poor old beleaguered Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's hapless successor as president. But we don't do that anymore. That was the Civil War. That was a bloodbath. The country had come apart in the most horrible way. And Watergate, Vietnam, the turmoil of that time, well, you know, it's become almost a requirement since Clinton for Congress to impeach presidents. And Clinton was trivial. That was trivial. Mitch McConnell said so. We made a big blunder. But that further opened the door, so now we impeach presidents.
Interesting.
So what? What else is new?
Wow. We're speaking with Dr. Art Sear, and this is his monthly visit to the program. We're going to talk about another political leader beleaguered in different respects. I'm talking about the president of Venezuela. And you have a recent column in which you talk about President Nicolas Maduro, once again, in your words, stealing another election.
Yeah, not beleaguered enough. He's still there.
but you also suggest that that there is maybe at least some hope for reversal of his fortunes that have allowed him to so corruptly cling to power. What are the what causes for hope are there in this situation?
Well, not many, but the environment has changed it's a sea change in Latin America as recently as the 80s. Outside of good old nice Costa Rica, which doesn't have an army and I believe has a U.S. dollar economy, and it's a place that doesn't give Uncle Sam any trouble at all. Democratic governments were few and far between, and they didn't last long. And for many, many years, Cuba seemed to be the way of the future during the Cold War. Unbelievable, but true. They weren't all left-wing regimes, but fascism was deeply entrenched. Nazi Germany and Japan had good hopes of working together to, in a strategic sense, to really make gains in Latin America until well into World War II. If there were free elections, often the military would mobilize and tanks would take over, and that would be it. Today, outside of Cuba, there's no real dictatorship in Latin America. Venezuela does have elections. All countries have elections that are more and more honest. In Latin America, as in Africa and the rest of the world, women are increasingly prominent and successful in politics. The main opposition leader to Maduro is a woman. She is public enemy number one, and she was prohibited from running, so the candidate was a male in the last election. But there are all these positive trends. Speaking of the military, the Maduro regime pays them off. It's utterly corrupt. And so whether it's just pure good old cash or drugs or liquor or physical assets or women or whatever you guys want. So it's purely cynical, and this Tribune of the People on the political left, I mean, it's the worst kind of corruption. But it's not, it can't last.
Right.
It can't last. That's not the way the world is moving.
Right. And you certainly point to the region in which Venezuela is located. I think even beyond all of Latin America, but, you know, some of Venezuela's neighbors, including Colombia, for instance, it's a very different story. And I think you're pointing to the possibility that just rising water will raise all the boats, and that there's every possibility that maybe probability that Venezuela will ultimately begin tilting in this same direction.
Lula da Silva in Brazil, the biggest country in just about every way in Latin America. Venezuela has a lot of oil income, but they've been under sanctions for decades now. Lula da Silva has encouraged Maduro to step down. And the Wall Street Journal has had very interesting, in-depth reporting about private efforts by the Biden administration, in particular Secretary of State Blinken, to get Maduro to step down in return for amnesty, in return for being guaranteed no prosecution for his many, many crimes. But most important is the larger picture. Early in the 20th century, The Economist described Argentina as the United States of the future. Argentina will be like the U.S. and fairly soon, because they have an enormous country, tremendous agricultural resources, a large Native American population, large black population, large European population. In their case, it was German immigrants. And the future is just, after decades of fascism and militarism and dictatorship and corruption, Juan Perón, who's still widely admired in Argentina, not just by old people, Argentina's a basket case. Eventually, you got to face reality.
In the case of Venezuela, you tell us that there's a real political crisis there because of an ongoing economic disaster. What is at the root of the economic woes of Venezuela?
Well, years and years of mismanagement and corruption. And there's something called the resource curse that economists refer to. Countries that are enormously well endowed with a particular resource, most notably petroleum, they tend to rely on that income. Saudi Arabia, they spend a lot, and they want to do a lot, but they don't get the job done because they have a guaranteed income, and the clique at the top doesn't want to give up power.
Interesting.
It is interesting. Yeah, I'm sorry I've been talking too much, but no. We're covering a lot of ground this morning. Thank you. It's always so stimulating, Greg, listening and talking with you.
So let's finish out with a couple of other interesting topics, but let me just reintroduce you for those of you that might be just joining us. Today is the monthly visit of Dr. Art Sear to the morning show. One of the interesting things about your last four columns is that we're in America, Venezuela, Russia, and the Far East, Japan, Korea. And so just the length and breadth of the ground that you covered in these last four columns is really pretty intriguing. Let's talk about the recent military exercises that began just a couple of days ago. Exercises that have gone on before involving U.S. and South Korean forces, but there was something different this time around, and the difference was the very direct and, I gather, high-profile participation of Japan.
Yes.
So tell us, first of all, kind of the history behind relations between Korea and Japan and what made Japan's participation in these recent exercises such a surprise.
Well, Japan is not, I should have been clearer in the column, Japan is not directly participating in the ROK, Republic of Korea, U.S. exercises, but they are now closely allied with Korea, longtime allies of the U.S. since the peace treaty in the early 1950s. But Korea and Japan are traditionally enemies. But late last year, speaking of foreign policy accomplishment, President Biden hosted a summit of the prime ministers of the South Korea and Japan, and they signed a formal trilateral peace agreement with the U.S. as the broker. And this significantly changes the strategic situation in Northeast Asia, but throughout the Asia region. We think of Japan in basically positive terms, especially since the fading of our intense economic competition since the 90s. But the rest of Asia, outside of Taiwan, tends to view Japan with considerable hostility and great fear related to World War II and Japan's invasion of Manchuria and then occupation of much of China and the Pacific. And the fact that these countries are allying, especially from Beijing's point of view, has got to be extremely intimidating. In doing my scrambling around like Dagwood Bumstead, you know, running here and there trying to get information for the weekly column by the deadline, Pyongyang and Beijing have both been quite muted in complaining. They usually complain hysterically about the U.S. and South Korea with the usual insane accusations and launching some missiles, or they've been launching balloons with trash over South Korea. They're quite muted this time. And I argue in the column that the changing relationship with Japan, which is also rearming, is a big not hidden, but big, subtle factor. Mm. Yeah, that's it, subtle.
Yeah.
That's clear.
Yeah.
I wish the column was clearer.
Yeah. No, I think I just kind of misremembered the involvement of Japan. I just ended up overstating it. I'm glad you for the correction. One of my favorite lines in this column is when you say, erratic North Korea behavior is now routine.
Yes.
And I think, you know, part of what you're pointing to is that sometimes the outrageous things that North Korea does, it's very easy, very tempting maybe, to overreact. And after a while, I mean, particularly if you have a long enough memory to remember all of the craziness that has come out of North Korea over so many years, none of it should come as a particular shock anymore.
No, and they do have rudimentary nuclear weapons. They're ICBMs, and intercontinental ballistic missiles now have a capacity to reach the continental U.S., We've also deployed anti-THAAD, anti-ballistic missile systems in South Korea and elsewhere, Guam, for that reason. But they are getting stronger. But the most important point, beyond all the hyperbole, is since 1953, the armistice is held. There are violent incidents, including North Korean suicide squads, not lately, going south. But the armistice is held.
Mm-hmm.
President Truman and Secretaries Acheson, especially the president, but Secretaries Acheson and Marshall and the others in that great administration deserve credit for defending South Korea in 1950 when the North invaded. But it was a terrible stalemate. The Truman administration was in a quagmire. And Eisenhower deserves great credit for ending the war. He promised to do that and did it a few months after becoming president in 53. He did that by engaging in mass slaughter. There were almost no military targets left in North Korea. Joseph Stalin had the was extremely helpful. He died. The Soviet Union had initiated that war and was a big stumbling block. So he died. That's Eisenhower's luck. Secretary of State Dulles threatened to use the atomic bomb, and we moved nuclear weapons to the region and did other things that indicated we might well use nuclear weapons. Not, you got to really dig in the history books, but it's there. Since there were no military targets left, we started killing everyone. Carpet bombing, bombed dikes and dams, which is a war crime. The electricity grid in northeastern China, as well as all of North Korea, such as it was, went down. All traffic stopped, such as it was. And for acres, miles in North Korea, there was nothing but water and dead bodies. And I'm convinced that Eisenhower was very good at keeping all of this out of the major media and also history books, and there's no paper trail that goes beyond General Mark Clark, the commander, and the White House. That's Eisenhower in action. But I'm convinced that U.S. officers in Panmunjom said, you know, we can keep this up 24/7 forever until you're all dead or you'll wish you're dead. And so that's why they signed on the dotted line.
And as you say, the, for whatever cost was necessary for that armistice ultimately to be signed, that armistice has held all these years.
And that's
later.
Why.
Yeah,
it's a terrifying memory,
right.
Especially for the leaders at the top, even though it was so long. And that's the real Eisenhower. There were very cold-blooded reasons why Roosevelt and Marshall picked him over a large number of more senior generals. The real man was not the goofy grandfather he pretended to be to reassure mom and pop America.
Wow.
Yeah.
To finish out today...
Well, we were losing that war.
Yeah.
Initially.
To finish out, let's talk about good news out of Russia for a change, namely the release of a journalist from... the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, Gershkovich.
Yes, the release of Evan Gershkovich and I believe, if I remember correctly, 15 other political prisoners. A cause, in your words, for relief and rejoicing. Tell us about this this release and its ultimate significance.
Well, it's a great success for the Biden administration and U.S. government professionals. There are full-time people in the White House and State Department who stay out of the news, whose full-time job, including some ex-military types, retired, is to get our people back. And it's a great compliment and source of strength of our system that we do that. The Vietnamese and North Koreans are really fascinated and puzzled by the fact that these Americans, they will spend thousands of dollars and dedicated people will go sifting through the soil and go off into the jungle or into other difficult to try to get to find something, some DNA of a dead American. Very strange from their point of view, but it's a great source of strength for our system. We we do go to great lengths to bring our people back. A big sticking point in Vietnam was POWs. And Hanoi, like Putin, was very cold-blooded in using them very cynically to get their advantage. We as part of this deal with Moscow, we released at least one contract killer, a hitman, who's very, very close to President Putin. And I would imagine President Putin's glad he is, rather than working for his many enemies. But this man was in prison in Germany for an assassination, and the Germans didn't want to do it, but we finally got them to do it. It's a great, great victory for U.S. foreign policy, and it's important to emphasize these days, beleaguered retiring President Biden. Big, big success for our side. We should all feel good about that. Every single person listening to this program, whatever your politics, should feel very good about that quality of ours.
And you mentioned in your column that Mr. Gerskovich, again, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, was the first U.S. journalist to be arrested in Russia since the Cold War.
That's Thank you. I should have mentioned that. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, and you call it, you know, this arrest is, you know, one of many, but you call it a really textbook example of Putin's ruthless repressive means.
Increasingly, yeah. And the journal, there are other people that we don't know about because they're not in the news, but the journal relentlessly was reminding us that they're, speaking of loyalty, the journalists... to be commended. They wouldn't let anybody forget about the fact that their young colleague Evan was being might not come back, and he was there, and it was criminal.
Right. So his release, big news that is worth acknowledging and celebrating. And on that upbeat note, our time is up, and we need to finish out this conversation, but I want to appreciate express once again my appreciation to you, Dr. Art Sear, for joining me today on the morning show. It's always great to speak with you, and look forward to further conversations about an array of interesting topics. And thank you for today's conversation.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your loyalty, as we talked about at the beginning. It means a lot to me.
Good to have you here. Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to be playing the interview that I recorded with sports writer Ian O'Connor, the author of a really, really interesting book about longtime Green Bay Packers quarterback, now New York Jets quarterback, Aaron Rodgers. The book is intriguingly titled Out of the Darkness, The Mystery of Aaron Rodgers. And we'll be talking with Ian O'Connor tomorrow about Aaron Rodgers, his life, his career, and all that has made him a rather divisive figure both in and out of the NFL, and particularly a lot of the ways in which his stance on a lot of different issues has dramatically changed over the last several years. And Ian O'Connor explores some of the reasons why. So that interview with Ian O'Connor tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois is for mostly sunny skies today. And we'll actually have daytime highs only in the mid-70s today, maybe 75 degrees or so to be our daytime high today. More like 80 degrees for a high tomorrow. Mid-80s over the weekend, close to 90 by Monday. This is WGTDHD. Kenosha.